Harry Carson was so exhausted by his first high school football practice in Florence, South Carolina, that he bailed out early and quit the team. Several decades later, in 2006, following a 13-year career with the New York Giants and a wait that lots of his contemporaries felt was longer than it should have been, Carson was inducted into the Football Hall of Fame. Now, Harry Carson has written a book titled Captain for Life, My Story as a Hall of Fame Linebacker, and he joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Mr. Carson, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
You earned all sorts of honors as a linebacker with the New York Giants, who drafted you in 1976. You got all-rookie honors. You played on a Super Bowl winner in 1986. You were selected to play in 9 Pro Bowls. But I gather from the book that what you value most is what some of the guys you hit said about how hard you hit them. And one of those guys was O.J. Simpson. Tell us about the particular post-game encounter with him that stands out for you.
I was walking off the field after playing against the San Francisco 49ers. And O.J. Simpson was the running back of that team at the time. He had already had his heyday with the Buffalo Bills, and it was his last year. And I remember him coming up to me, and he tugged at my jersey. And he said, "Hey, Carson." And I said, "Hey, Juice, what's up?" He said, "Man, I've been hit by some of the best, but I've never been hit as hard as you hit me today." And when he said that, you know, I was floored, because here's a guy who at the time held the NFL rushing records. He had rushed for over 2,000 yards in one season. I took it as a great compliment.
In 1986, with Bill Parcells as head coach, the Giants won the Super Bowl. How important was that win in terms of your own self-esteem as a player?
It was a great win after those down years in the early or late 70s and early 80s. It was the fulfillment of a commitment that we all made toward one another. It was gratifying to me because for a guy like me and George Martin, who had been a part of the team during those lean years, we saw just how bad it was for the fans, for the players, for the Giant organization. And to win a Super Bowl, it was much sweeter for us as older players as opposed to some of the younger guys who were coming in. So it was gratifying from that standpoint.
You devote a large portion of Captain for Life to the damage inherent in the game, and you describe one play during a game against the Redskins in 1982 when you were hit in the head and found you couldn't understand what the defensive coach, Bill Belichick, was calling from the sideline. How did you hide your confusion from your teammates and coaches?
Well, you know, when you play, especially back then, you played a very physical game. We were playing the Washington Redskins, and we were playing down in RFK Stadium. Riggins is a running back who didn't try to run around you. They ran one play where we hit head-to-head. And so I got up, and I went back to the huddle. So I looked over to the sideline, and everything faded to black. And it was just a momentary thing where I just lost my vision. I squeezed the hands of the guys next to me, and, you know, my eyesight was restored. I realized I was in a football game. I'm the captain. I looked over to the sideline. Bill Belichick flashed in the signal for the next defense on the next play. I did not understand what the signal was, and so I tapped my helmet, and he flashed the signal again. And I still could not interpret what the defense was. At the time, I didn't realize that I had sustained a concussion. For me, I just got my bell rung. And so it's not about keeping anything from my teammates. It wasn't about keeping anything from the coaches or trainers. It was something that was just part of the game.
Tell us about how you learned after your career that your head injuries were going to have long-term consequences.
Well, I knew something was going on when I played, and I couldn't really put my finger on exactly what the issues were. Once I left football, it was a different story because I went into broadcasting, and I would go on the air, and there were times when I would lose my train of thought live. But there were some of these other issues, tingling in my arms occasionally, Whenever, you know, I would sit for a period of time and I would stand up, I would lose my balance, or everything would fade to black, and I'd feel like, you know, I was about to faint. So I went to my doctor for my yearly physical. He referred me to a neurosports psychologist. And I went to this guy. I went through 2 days of testing. And he came back and he said, "You have a mild post-concussion syndrome." And I said, "Okay, am I going to live?" And he said, "Yeah, you'll live." Then I just went on to, you know, begin to live my life in such a way that I knew that I was going to have issues, but I had to understand the issues that I was dealing with and how to manage those issues.
As you say in the book, for years, the National Football League denied the connection between head injuries players suffered and conditions like memory loss and migraines, depression, and other neurological problems. Do you think that over the past year or so, the league and the Players Association have become more responsible about addressing the problems and challenges faced by former players?
The league is beginning to understand what is going on with retired players. It was frustrating for many years because many of these players were dealing with issues and nobody really believed them. There were people who thought that these players were, you know, pulling their leg, or it was some way to get more disability or so forth. But the NFL, I think, is now more plugged into the issues of traumatic brain injury and neurological problems in the players. And I think they're taking these players at their word now more than ever.
You write that you would not want your own sons to play pro football, obviously because of the injury factor. And I can't help asking, if were someone to give you the opportunity to roll back the clock to the day after that first high school football practice, you would have chosen then to keep playing the game.
I knew at the age of 7 that you could get hurt playing football. And I went to my first college football game, and I saw players help another player off the field, and he was hobbling off the field. So I recognized very early on that you could get hurt playing. And I analyzed that risk, and I assumed that risk, and I think every player assumes that risk, that he could get hurt. But, you know, you go ahead and you play. From a neurological standpoint, though, if someone had told me I could sustain some kind of damage that might be lifelong, I would have turned down the opportunity to play. Part of the reason why I wrote the book is I want people who either watch football, have kids who play, want to play football, players who are playing football, players who have played football, people who just go out and buy popcorn and a beer and they watch the Super Bowl. I want everybody to understand the neurological risk that these players are taking by playing the game. They can recover from a knee injury. They can always get the knee replaced. They can always get a hip replaced. No big deal. You'll still be able to move on and be functional. But once you injure the brain, that is a different story. For someone who has already played the game, they may be looking at potential memory loss. They may be looking at Alzheimer's. They may be looking at dementia and so forth. I just want people to be fully informed now.
Harry Carson, who played for 13 years with the New York Giants, is the author of Captain for Life, My Story as a Hall of Fame Linebacker. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. And Mr. Carson joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Harry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
To hear more of my conversation with Harry Carson, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
This year's edition of the World Gravy Wrestling Championships at the Rosen Bowl Pub, Stackstead's Rosendale, drew an impressive 1,500 spectators, a turnout host and landlord John Lowe termed superb. Winners of each bout were determined by a vote of the audience, some members of which wore flecks of gravy despite their attempts to keep the action at a distance. Contestants dressed as chickens, little Bo Peep, and various other creatures, real and imaginary, mucked about in the gravy ring to raise money for the East Lancashire Hospice. Elliot Rourke, who won last year's contest dressed as a bunny girl, failed to repeat, perhaps because of the texture of the medium. I would say the gravy was of a slightly finer consistency than it was last year, Rourke said.